I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Marissa Ross.
And I'm Adam Horvulis, and we're the host of Natural Disasters.
It's a podcast about natural wine and shit. Every week, we're going to be going through the basics, the ins and outs, and the culture around natural wine, and, you know, other shit that we just decided that we kind of want to talk about, but mostly wine.
Yeah, I mean, have you had that friend that has showed up to your house with a bottle of wine and gone, "This is natural wine," and you're like, "I wish I knew a little bit more about that," and was entertained?
Or maybe you're the friend that's like, "Yo, this is some natty wine," and you just want to learn more about said natty wine. This could be a good podcast for you, too.
Or maybe you know everything about wine, and you just want to listen to some really entertaining people drink wine and chit-chat.
Yeah, we do a lot of that, too.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I went to a Pusha T show recently. That was really fun.
That's pretty amazing.
It was great, except I was really looking for Kanye to come out, and then he didn't. And even though, you know, I'm still a little mad at him, but we don't need to get into that. Anyways... wine and shit.
Yeah. Join us, Natural Disasters Pod on Heritage.
Yes, on Heritage Radio Network. It's the best. We're really excited.
All right.
All right. Bye. Bye. Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen in izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is so mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify this program with my co-guests. My guest today is Elizabeth Ando, who already joined us 6 times on episodes 18, 61, 83, 99, 108, and 131. And she shared her truly deep insight into traditional Japanese food culture. And Elizabeth is a food writer and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has lived in Japan for over 50 years. And she runs a culinary arts program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. So you should check it out if you have a plan to go to Japan. It's called A Taste of Culture. And Elizabeth is also the author of 6 cookbooks, including an award-winning Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Kitchen, and Kibo, Recipes and Stories from Japan's Tohoku, and the Kansha, Celebrating Japan's Vegan and Vegetarian Traditions. And today's topic is really fun. As you may know, we have the new emperor in Japan, and Emperor Akihito formally abdicated, and the Crown Prince Naruhito was inaugurated as the 126th emperor on May 1st. And as a result, the name of the Japanese era changed from Heisei to Reiwa. The Japanese era is commonly used along with the Western calendar, and it's really a big deal to start a new era. So today, Elizabeth will reflect on the major food trends in Japan during the era, the last era, Heisei, which began in 1989 and ended in May after 30 years. So, before we start, quickly, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as a podcast, and also as a Spotify. And please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. I will appreciate your feedback. And if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. Let's start our conversation with Elizabeth Sandow. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm so excited about having you again.
Thank you. When you read off the numbers, I said, my goodness, lots of chances to talk, and I have yet another one today, so
yeah,
that's great.
Well, we have a lot more to come, I think.
I hope so.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about. You're such a knowledgeable person, so I really appreciate you're such an asset for us.
Thank you.
So let's start with the Japanese era. How are the Japanese people reacting to having the new emperor?
Amazing. And
studying? Yeah,
really amazing. I expected people to get excited, but I didn't think it was going to be quite this big a deal, and it was huge. It was combined with a very extended holiday. The Golden Week holidays are usually about a week, maybe 8 days at most, if people sort of string them all together. This year it was more than 10 days, depending upon how you took your time off. And there were a number of events, lots of excitement around the beginning of a new era, and also a very positive sort of farewell. Not so much a farewell as in Japan, Gokuro-sama, Otsukare-sama, you've done such a good job, you deserve to now rest and get a chance to have the rest of your life more privately. It was all a very, very positive and exciting sort of time. I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't quite as low-keyed as I had thought it might be. It was very prominent.
Right. Because of the previous Akihito, Emperor Akihito kind of abdicated, which is very unusual, the first time in 200 years or something.
It really was, and there was a great discussion about it. Was this really acceptable, and what was going to happen moving forward with the imperial household, and who would be next thereafter? The current emperor and empress have a daughter. They don't have a son. Mm. What's to become of the Japanese imperial line? There was quite a bit of discussion and speculation, and also about the name of the era. It was very interesting. There were private betting circles, if you will, as to what the name of the new era was going to be. And lots of people, myself included, expected it to start with a K or an R, because there are still people alive who were born in the Meiji period at the turn of the previous century, and that begins with an M. Then came the Taisho period, which starts with a T, and then Showa, S, Heisei, H, and it had to be something different. So my bets were on something beginning with a K and probably Kofuku, but not at all. So it's Reiwa instead. And the connection is to the Manyoshu, which is an ancient anthology of poetry. So it's very indigenous to Japan. Mm-hmm. I think another statement that this is a ritual, a routine that the Japanese take seriously about themselves. It's part of their identity.
Right. So what's the meaning of Reiwa?
As far as I know, the character Rei means to decree, to proclaim, and the wa is harmony. So it's an era of harmony has been declared.
Right.
And so certainly everybody hopes so. Yes, yes.
More than any other time, I think. Right. So, okay. And so let's dive into the Heisei food trends. Because there's, 30 years, there are a lot of
interesting
trends.
Interesting. You know, it is interesting. Every culture has different sort of markers, kugiri, as to how they're going to break up a long period of time. And as far as I can figure out in America, it's pretty much by decade. Mm-hmm. So here are three decades sort of linked together. And I think they do have a common theme about them. But there are also lots of separate little sub-themes through that time period. there are certain foods that became ridiculously popular. And one way of measuring popularity is how long the line is to wait to get in.
That's so funny. So whenever I go to Japan, like there is a one spot new
right.
where people are lining up for hours.
Hours. And you wonder if it's worth it, but people claim it is, that they want to be one of the first, one of the only.
So I think it's a big difference. Sorry, I just interrupted, I think this is important to, see how Japanese trend begins. Because in my opinion, in America, there are so many, different diversity of the ethnicity to regional differences. It's the United States anyway. So it's like, to me, the different states kind of, a country.
Right.
But in Japan, there's a national broadcasting system and it's dominant. So once somebody will see it, I remember that's the mascarpone cheese.
Right.
When tiramisu became popular, it's like a novel dessert from Italy. And so tiramisu was like, wow, that's amazing. And I wanted to try make one. That was a long time ago when I was still in Japan. And just all mascarpone cheese was sold out because everybody just wants to make it.
It's true. And even more so now with the internet and with social media. And overnight, something can really take off. It's very prone to trends. I think sometimes it's harder for people to develop a long-term project. And it's very easy to catch the attention. If you get the right media coverage, you're going to get a lot of people lining up at your door. Clearly, if the food isn't good or the product that you're offering isn't worth it, it's unlikely people will come back for more.
Right.
But the Japanese are very brand conscious and very status conscious. Right.
That's funny you said that because I looked up why the tiramisu became so popular, and it's a magazine, and that time was really popular magazine, Hanako.
Yes.
Hanako featured as a must dessert for cool modern women.
But of course, and that's why. I mean, so everybody had to do it. And today there are a number of blogs and surveys. I had sent you links to a couple of them in the Japanese media that had rankings and the idea of ranking popularity of food. Do American journalists do that?
You could see it.
Yeah.
But doesn't capture clear popularity that people would agree on.
Yeah. And also the thing by which they measure it, so this gyoretsu gourmet, this long line gourmet, to measure what percentage of the population would be willing to stand in line for an hour or more to try it, is sort of an interesting marker.
Right. So let's talk about some of those the items that people line up for.
Well, on the top of the list, but it was early on because it was 1989 was the year that was given for ramen and tsukemen. I was so surprised at how early it had taken on. There are still lots of ramen shops that have lines around the block. Pancakes, and I understand that a fluffy pancake has just come to New York.
Yeah. Can you just stay with the ramen for a second? Because that was a bubble economy, right?
Yes.
So it's really like everybody's going out, dining out, and I heard there's so many different kinds of new ramen shops to attract those people.
Yes. Again, I think the Japanese really like to be on top of the latest trend and to be able to say that they've been there, they've done it, and talk to others. It has a lot of social power, I think, within any particular group.
Right. So that sounds similar to New Yorkers, right?
I don't know. I guess maybe, but the Japanese are really into limited opportunities, but they grabbed it. In Japan, very often people are able to say, there's only 50 of these available every day, and people will line up to buy them.
Right.
Whereas I'm not sure that Americans would say, well, so I don't get it. What big deal? Mm. I'm not sure that people would feel deprived of an opportunity to be special.
Right. And the scarcity.
The scarcity of something actually adds value in Japan. Rather than here, I have a feeling most people just figure it's not worth it. I don't know. So it's possible that this, lines around the corner measurement of popularity has to do with only a few people can have it.
Right.
And are you going to be one of those few?
Right. Yeah. Well, I remember still like cronuts, Dominican style, you know, the special dessert. And I had a sense in Japan, like, people tend to line up in different places, but it's like there's no specific group of people who don't mind lining up. But in Japan, let's just get it. And it's such a gift culture too.
Right.
If you line up, share it with my friends. The kind of mindset still there too.
Yeah, it's quite different. But I think ramen is probably here to stay. Mm. I don't know that the wild variety of different soup stocks and toppings and that will continue to, excite the imagination of chefs. I have a feeling that a few will probably become very popular and stay around for a very long time.
Well, that's another common thing between, I think, New Yorkers and, Japanese people in general. Pretty open-minded. They're looking for something new.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. But sorry that I interrupted you.
No,
pancake.
Yeah, so pancakes. What interested me was apparently somebody sent me a review of a Japanese place that opened recently in New York, the big fluffy pancakes. And I was sort of surprised. It's sort of returning back to where it came from, because certainly pancakes are not part of the traditional Japanese food culture, but one that people enjoy. And probably because of texture. The Japanese are very big into the texture, the mouthfeel of food.
It's a big deal in Japan.
It's a very big deal. As important, I think, as taste.
Mm.
And so a pancake that is fluffy, sort of almost like a souffle, sort of captured, I think, the imagination and the taste buds of people. And so now we'll see whether New York really catches on or not to the same.
I think that that time, 2014, I think.
Right.
So around that time, the American, pancake brands went to Japan, and it's kind of like media attention.
Yes.
Really abundant.
Yeah.
So that's...
Media does drive a lot, but I think that one of the values of the internet and social media is that almost anybody could really do their own promotion and really try to get the attention. It doesn't have to be an already organized, large publishing organization. It's both good and bad because nobody's really monitoring it, but it does give an opportunity to people to present new ideas, new possibilities out there.
One thing I noticed, so I had a recently guest from Egg Owner.
Ooh.
Yeah. George Welt talked about his experience. He brought Egg, invited by, business partner in Japan. And I did research, and all the media coverage is very friendly. I think in general, Japanese media tend to be less critical. Try to see good side. And if it's good, people try it and accept. And restaurants live longer. Like 20, 30 years is not uncommon.
Right. I think that, saying something positive, meaning it's going to be valuable to the person who's listening to it, rather than complaining, is the general style or tone of Japanese food journalism.
Right.
There are critical voices, but only if it's going to be helpful. It's not personal complaining.
So I think here in New York, for instance, opening after 3 months of opening, it's all the media comes and you are judged.
Yes.
Leave all that, that's right. So I don't think in Japan that's more gradual.
I'm not as familiar with the latest openings. I haven't really been following them all that much, but I suspect that there's a bit of the same.
Mm.
But in general, people are looking for something good.
Mm.
And they'll try to find something worth saying,
right,
if they're going to, especially an established publication, because it's very limited space.
Mm.
And they don't feel that it's worth spending that space on critical reviews that don't do anybody any good. Just knowing that the person who went for the meal didn't enjoy it is not...
Right. Yeah, so why bother?
Why bother to take up the space of the publication?
Right. Yeah, that's why Japanese food guidebooks, even if I don't go, sometimes I just write, oh my God, yeah, I dream about going to this place and that place. So anyway, what's the next trend you want to feature?
There were lots of them. One of the ones that sort of interested me was the Sanuki Udon. Mm. My first Japan experience was in the Sanuki region on the island of Shikoku. And another sort of popular, certainly in terms of food TV, are there food tours that are shown? Whenever I come, I turn on the TV here, but I haven't seen the kind of show that's very popular in Japan where literally you go to a region and you eat that region.
Mm, it's like Anthony Bourdain, Japanese version.
Yeah,
kind of.
Maybe, except it's not personality dominated much.
Right. It's more like tour guide.
Yeah, it really is a more neutral. It's less through a personal lens of a journalist,
right,
than it is through a publication or a TV studio that has done some research.
Mm.
They find who they think is going to be the right narrator for the piece,
right,
and they try to eat every variety of that particular food.
Mm.
And that was, I think, part of what launched the udon craze, mm-hmm, in Japan. And the year that this particular ranking gave was 1998, so sort of the turn into this century.
Right. And one thing I heard about this, the beginning, Kagawa, it's in Shikoku, Kagawa, right, Prefecture, and Sanuki is the area, if you think of... You know, if you think of pizza, it's Italy. It's a kind of a udon equivalent, you
sort
say.
Of, yeah.
Yeah. So there was an editor of, right, a local magazine who came up with, let's just do... It's happened. He didn't really try to promote it. That's what I heard. But he came up with, it's really fun to write a guidebook so that you can have a guide. You can walk around and then eat udon in that area.
Right.
So I heard that was the beginning of.
There's also a pilgrimage in Shikoku, and many people refer to this as the noodle pilgrimage. And people would go from one stop to another, and indeed there were lots of noodle shops that were.
There's
near.
No hardship.
No. Any place you stop, you're going to find udon noodles, and they're typically rather casual, mom and pop kind of operations,
right.
And there's the basic noodles, and then the broth and the toppings, and so the notion of going on a noodle pilgrimage was played up at the time.
So I'm sure that Sanuki udon pilgrimage kind of applied to other regions,
yes,
which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, I think so too. Mm. For all of that, and then a lot of things that I think were not. You know, originally in Japan, things like popcorn or...
I heard of popcorn, that was like 2016.
Yeah.
I think there are, again, American popcorn brands went into Japan and inspired.
In my mind, but I guess I'm dating myself, popcorn is when you go to the movies. And, you know, nobody was going to movie theaters anymore. Certainly, right, there are movie theaters still in Japan, but it's a very different sort of dynamic. And the whole notion that popcorn would be something that you would eat when you weren't at the movie theater sort of was unusual to me. But again, the Japanese love to take something and make it theirs,
right,
put their own imprint on it.
Mm. Mm. I think it's more of a mirroring American culture and high-end popcorn from Chicago or something like that.
Right.
It's like, that's something new.
Yeah.
Right. The other thing I wanted to ask, kakigori. Yeah.
Yes, I love it.
So that became popular in 2017?
Well, it's very old-fashioned. I forget the exact date, but I'm going to say it was Meiji. Mm. When that machine, it's now a very old-fashioned machine, but depending upon how you cut ice, mm-hmm. the texture really changes.
Oh, so can you maybe define what kakigori is?
For well, sorry, it's shaved ice, and I think lots of cultures have shaved ice, but how the ice is frozen and how it's shaved, the angle at which the blade hits the ice, really does change the texture. And again, the Japanese are very into texture to mouthfeel. And there are some kakigori establishments that have very fluffy ice. It almost is like almost like cotton candy.
Right. So it's not like Italian ice. It's like, you know, cotton. It's made to order.
Right.
Right.
No, no. Each time you go and it's put in a machine and the block of ice. And also the way in which the water is frozen. So there's no air bubbles in there. There's no impurities.
It's like
in
a cocktail ice, expensive cocktail ice.
It's not cheap, but it's certainly worth it. I'm a traditionalist. I like kintoki, which is the sweet beans with matcha. So I'm a
right. Yeah, it's. I think every kid grew up in Japan has a memory of kakigori. It's really hot and humid, and
so can I interrupt? How do you eat it? Because there are also different ways of eating it, so that it doesn't all collapse on you.
It's like a nice. I think.
Do you go from
stainless,
inside?
This cold glass or, the big cup shaped and shaved on top. And then you pick very chemical and sugary syrup.
Right.
Shocking green or shocking pink. Right. And I used to love that strawberry flavored, very chemical. Yeah. But that's kids, right?
Right.
And I broke from the top.
Wow. And it didn't all collapse on you?
That was the thrill.
Huh.
Yeah. Okay. I think I was eating with my brother. He doesn't care. I'm more like concocting, the shape of it.
I used to pick from the bottom because then it would sort of collapse on itself. And it was interesting in the summertime if you watched other people eating at the same time and who would start on the top and who would start at the bottom. And other people would sort of pick on the side, turn the glass around and then go at it as well. But it's one way to survive a Japanese summer, the hot, sticky weather. I think it's always been popular, but it was particularly focused on, and I don't know if it was Hanako or another women's magazine that had done a piece on kakigori.
I think it's a good thing because it's such a culturally deeply rooted, simple food.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And by the way, there's a new kakigori shop in New York.
I'm going to have a guest.
So I'm going to have a guest this summer. I'll keep you posted.
Good. I have to listen to that one. Right. Great.
So, and I think there's a beer garden.
Yes. Again, hot, sticky summers, and the Japanese like to go out for a drink with their colleagues. I mean, that's true in large urban centers like New York here, too.
Mm-hmm. But it was recent, like in 2017. So what's behind it, do you think?
Well, I think there always were these places, certain specials, combinations of beer snacks and different kinds of beer, and especially jibiru, the craft beers. And again, I think they always existed, but the attention was not focused on them. And Instagram also changed the nature of information transfer in Japan. The Japanese are also very visual. Texture is big, but so is visual images. And people, as a matter of fact, when Instagram first became sort of popular in Japan, Instabai, it was referred to as the new itadakimasu. So before you would start to eat, instead of saying, I'm about to receive and thank you for this great food, people would take a picture first. Mm. I mean, you were always taught when you were growing up to say itadakimasu before you start to eat.
Right.
But even before then, you have to take the picture and then upload it, and then you could say itadakimasu and go ahead and eat something.
Yeah, there's always a positive and negative comments about, you know, taking pictures of food. But I think a lot of restaurants started to now promote it because it's a good...
It really is. It's a way of getting a buzz, people to talk about something and to be curious about it. Yeah.
Yeah, then we learn something good.
Yes.
So I think I'm supporting that trend.
Good.
Right. Any other trend?
In terms of TV, one of my favorite shows is something called Sarameshi. And the original meaning of it was a salary man and the lunchtime of salaried workers. But it, beyond its first pilot projects, which I think were about 6 months, there were a series of programs that had been made, and they were waiting to see whether it would be well-received or not. Mm-hmm. And it was very well-received. And they've expanded and done... programs beyond the noontime hour and really primetime television.
Mm. So basically it's a national TV program and featuring Salimen's lunch.
Sort of. They have a great research staff, and they have a few narrators who are personalities, people that are known to the Japanese viewer public. But they choose interesting places to discover. So it could be a crafts person's workshop, and what do they do for lunch? Mm. And they go in, and you see how they're working, you learn about their work, when they take a break, whether they take it together, whether somebody makes the food for other people, how they share it. So it's very much more than, you know, what does somebody who... makes an artisan knife eat for lunch.
Right.
It's that too, but it's also about it's more about the culture of people and how food helps to connect them. They've gone into small businesses where the president of the business actually once a week makes lunch for everybody who works there.
So it's basically capturing lifestyle through lunch,
and it's a behind the scenes view, the sort of the view that you didn't expect to see.
Interesting. Which TV station?
I knew you were going to ask. I think it's 6. It might be
the
8.
TV. Okay.
I'll make sure I check it up.
Okay, so the name is Sarameshi.
Sarameshi,
right.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, when I go to Japan and then, you know, turn on the TV, there's so many food programs.
Right.
And it's about the lifestyle. It's not just who's making it and the tradition and how it's enjoyed, all those.
It's very much in context. It's understanding why these people are eating this food and who made it and what went into it. And I think people really enjoy understanding it in the context in which it was presented. At the other end of the spectrum of food TV, here in America, there seem to be lots of contests and almost humiliating contests. Mm. In Japan, making fun of people is sort of in a different light.
Yeah.
there's a lot of that. And there's this one program where they stop young people in very heavily trafficked areas like Shibuya Station or someplace and ask them to make something that's pretty ordinary.
Right.
And they have out on the table all sorts of ingredients that absolutely don't belong there. Inevitably, they'll stop someone, very often a young woman who's with her boyfriend, and they'll ask the young woman to make, gyoza.
Mm.
And then the boyfriend has to eat it afterwards and comment on it.
So that they cook on the street?
They cook on the street on a burner. And if it's a traditional food, very often they get on their cell phone and call their grandmother and ask, you know, how do you make it? And the whole idea is sort of making fun of the fact that young people don't really pay attention to how the food is made that they eat. These are things that they eat all the time, and they never really give any thought to how it's made. And then the show finally also shows a professional making that food in a professional way.
So actually teaching
as well. Properly. But the real fun of it is sort of seeing what a botched mess these right. kids will make of the food. And people, but it's in a good-hearted spirit. It's not particularly mean. And there are still the food contests, eating contests.
What's the name of that program that you cook on the street?
Wasano Tokyo Magazine.
Okay, Wasano Tokyo Magazine.
And they obviously have to get permission to be able to set up a reasonable cooking station out in public, but they do, and it's interesting.
Right. And, of course, there is an Iron Chef, original Iron Chef, that was broadcast from 1993 to 1998.
Right.
And eventually was sold to Food Network here.
Yes.
So that really inspired a lot of young chefs now. So
I think so. When it first came on in Japan, there were a group of people in the profession who were almost offended that this notion of making a full meal out of a single ingredient would be made sort of fun of, that it would be made into a contest of some sort rather than respecting the food. But I think the food is entertainment. It was so entertaining. Mm. It was so people taking themselves too seriously.
Right. Because it used to be always cooking program tend to be very serious classroom style.
Yes.
So
yes.
that made food as entertainment, inviting men and kids and everybody.
Yes, so. And certainly the popularity of those original Iron Chef characterized a lot of Japanese food culture for a very, very long time.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a lot more to discuss, but we'll take a quick break. So when I come back, we'll continue more
Thank
trends.
Okay.
So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs Podcast live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Elizabeth Ando, a food writer and cookbook author and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So let's talk more about some other trends. So one thing I heard is that in 1999 to 2001, there is a little boom to eat uncooked, like raw chocolate, and raw camel. What is it about?
Well, the Japanese have always eaten raw eggs. And I think, again, it's a texture thing, and that unexpected... very intense flavor and accompanied by something that you can almost swallow rather than chew. I mean, the caramels were chewy, but very soft, very smooth, and very intense in flavor.
Right.
I think it was the intensity that was sort of caught people's attention.
Right. And also, it's raw means there's no preservative and you have to have a higher... high-quality ingredients,
yes.
the kind of exclusive idea also.
Yes, and I don't know that all of them were artisanally made rather than mass produced, but I'm going to presume that they were certainly small lot mass production. You could not have turned out those products in a very large factory.
Right.
They would have to have been given greater personal attention in making them. Yeah.
Yeah, and I heard that the origin of this royal caramel and royal chocolate, there's a farm called the Hanabatake Farm.
Right.
And their ingredients enable that fresh flavor. So I think that makes sense. Like, oh, well, that's fresh and more exclusive.
Yeah. And again, ingredient driven and effort. The Japanese have always felt that results are important, but effort is probably more important.
Mm-hmm.
And trying hard and really working hard and producing something that's special is recognized and valued.
Mm-hmm.
Not always does that equate with commercial success, but in the case of Namak caramel and choco, it certainly did.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So another thing I found is really interesting is around 2009, 2010, there's a term, soshokudanshi, meaning vegetarian.
Right.
Male.
Right.
And so this was like, you know, it changed the image of man has to be strong and never cry, doesn't do anything girly. It's that very positive term for those activities for men?
It's interesting because in my mind, one of the first things I recognized back in the 60s in Japan was that men do cry. Japanese men cry. And it's not necessarily, it depends upon the circumstances, but it doesn't necessarily show weakness per se.
Well, but I think that aspect is not showing weakness. It's more like, you know, purely loyal to something.
And
like
sympathy
justice.
Or, right. Yes. So, but what was also very obvious to me was the gender specificity of Japan, that many things were defined by gender. Men like this, men do this, women like this,
even
women
worse
do
than
this. Very much so. And in terms of food, women were expected to like sweets, and men to like spicy, bold flavors and saltier things. And men were not supposed to like vegetables. They were supposed to like meat, fish, things of that sort. And so I think what really happened here was sort of a rethinking of it and recognizing that it was almost a genderless kind of cuisine, that it didn't really have to be defined by men or by women per se. And there are some people who speculated, I don't know that there's any place you could get a definitive answer, that part of the Valentine's chocolate story in Japan, which is a bit of the reverse, meaning that women give chocolate to men for Valentine's, was because the chocolate industry wanted to expand the people who actually, because it had been thought of as being sweets as something that only women would eat. And so this way they could get men to like it too. I don't know that it's really true, but I'm not sure that that food really did have a gender identity to begin with, but certainly this extra little movement pushed it away from that, made it almost genderless. Women could go into yakiniku and steak restaurants and enjoy meat and bold flavors. And men could go to some of the tabehodai, the all-you-can-eat kinds of sweets restaurants. Nobody would think anything of it.
Yeah. That's a good trend. It's healthier. Right. And one thing I heard about what's in the background of this whole, you know, soshokudanshi trend is that, you know, convenience stores, you don't have to say who you are. You just go hop in, hop out. Within a minute, you can buy whatever you want to do or you want to buy. So Lawson, that's one of the biggest convenience store chains, launched premium roll cake.
Right.
And so 2009, they did it. They launched, started selling that premium roll cake. Even men, sweet lovers, they can right. buy it. So that was a hit. And other convenience stores followed. And you can buy anything you want in convenience stores.
Yes.
That's the secret. And it's we rely on, it's not the 7-Eleven here. Convenience store is your favorite bodega, supermarket. So,
but I think, I don't have the statistics, but I think that food is a huge portion of the income from any convenience store in Japan.
Right.
There are other products for sale and other services. Increasingly, there are services available at convenience stores.
Mm, you can pay a gas bill or whatever.
Yes, you can pay bills. You can postal services, sending packages, things of that sort can be done at convenience stores. But food is the main thing that they're selling.
Right.
And they are very definitely responsible for a lot of the trends
right.
that you see.
And the quality of food at convenience stores. I often talk about how convenience store in Japan is wonderful on this show, but it's really, becoming even more sophisticated too.
Yes.
So yeah. It's kind of like food trend, maybe sometimes inspired by convenience stores. That's my guess.
But you're right. It's anonymous. Nobody knows who you are and they don't have a chance to either comment or have an opinion about what you're buying.
Right.
You know, you line up, you pick it out, you pay for it, and then you take it home.
Right. So. And whenever I go to Japan, I go to convenience stores. There's new exciting items promoted
Always.
In the store.
Always.
So, yeah. Anyway, so the other thing is I heard is the people started to eat more meat.
Yes.
So is that because of a low-carb trend?
I'm not sure. I think that it may also be more convenient. A lot of younger people in particular have trouble eating fish properly.
Mm.
Whether it's eating a whole fish and knowing how to pick it off the bones.
Oh.
And it's more problematic. Most meat that is cooked and eaten, it's very straightforward. It doesn't require any skill on the part of the person who's eating it to actually cut it up and eat it. And I think that may have contributed somewhat to the popularity of meat. Definitely chopsticks are a skill that everybody in Japan has. But increasingly, you're finding people getting away from chopstick eating
right.
and knife and fork as well.
Too bad. There's so many beautiful chopsticks. But
and I can't eat salad with a knife and with a fork. I always ask for chopsticks.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And also, there is a aged meat trend in
yes.
Japan.
Yes.
About, I think, 2013. Probably was inspired by, the steak. Aged beef kind of influence from America. But yeah, it's amazing that Japanese people never eat beef or meat. Now it's becoming more
I think so. Definitely also away from a rice or grain-based eating, which may or may not be such a good thing. I mean, depending on who you're talking to and what
right.
they think of that particular dietary pattern. But very definitely there's a distancing from the previous generations where it was very grain-based,
right.
Rice noodles. And then you had a little bit of meat with that.
Right. So again, that's maybe over the internet. People have different kinds of diet influenced globally by low-carb to vegetarian, vegan.
Right.
Right.
But at the same time, to some extent, there are more products now that are reduced sodium, reduced sugar. People are more aware of the intake of particularly salt and sugar.
Right.
And trying to create alternative products that have less.
That's great, right? Because I think Japanese people tend to have more issues with high blood pressure because they tend to be more saltier food, pickles and stuff. So,
right.
yeah. All right. So, So we do discuss a lot of stuff. So personally, on reflection, how do you feel about the Heisei era, about the food?
Interesting and expansive. I never expected as much variety as actually was displayed. Again, it's a long period of time and a lot of things happened. But there were also a number of natural disasters, really large natural disasters, mm-hmm. through the Heisei period. And this return to comfort foods, things that were ultimately familiar. And so you saw a lot of very trendy things happening. 95 was the big quake down in the Kansai, centered around Kobe. And 2011 was the big quake up in the Tohoku. Mm-hmm. Those were the two very big sort of anchors around mini returns to very comfort, simple, uncomplicated food that people could share easily.
Right, to share. That's really important element. Yeah, I remember after 9/11 here in New York, it was the same. Yeah, all those expensive, you know, fancier places are gone, and everybody wants to share comfort food.
Yeah, and something that was going to be, had a good memory attached to it, something that would they would find strength to move forward, rather than worry about future trends. It was everybody was very focused on supporting getting back to normal for that. So I sort of see that sort of 30-year period as a series of waves back and forth between very exciting, very new, very challenging things and very home-style, very sort of low-keyed private comfort food.
So sounds like I think it's a good time, good era.
Very. Yeah. And Dewa should be a wonderful decree of harmony, and we'll see what that turns out to be.
Right. And probably, you know, again, over the internet, we get more interesting food. Yes. And also, I think, you know, this show exists because Japanese traditional food has a value. So there's going to be. Yeah, so I think the tradition should explore and progress to prosper.
Yes.
Father. So that's another thing. Right. So this is my last question. So, by looking at what we discussed, what do you think is unique about Japanese society and the people's lifestyle that creates the food trends?
I don't know that it's unique, meaning that they're the only people who do this, but I do think it's indicative, very specific to Japan. People value effort and quality, and that's not to say that finding it less costly someplace is not a cause for celebration, but they value effort that goes into making good products, and I think that that augurs well for the future. And they're very innovative, very creative in terms of thinking of new ways, new solutions if there's a problem, and new products just for the sake of fun. There's a lot of whimsy and fun in Japanese food as well. People talk about square watermelons and why bother with that, because it's a fun thing to imagine. There's a lot of food that is not serious, and I think that that's important, that people don't take themselves too seriously as well.
It's just funny that, you know, the classic pocky that used to be small, but like a giant pocky, that's one example. And the shaved ice, what's the better texture? It's classic. So never-ending pursuit of perfection.
and people being willing to try hard and to keep at it.
So let's see what's going to happen in this new era.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, so where can listeners find you online?
Tasteofculture.com is probably the best first stop. And on the homepage, you'll find links to other things that I'm doing. Tomorrow night, but I think it's sold out. I'm talking for the Culinary Historians of New York, a group, and going to be talking actually about aesthetics in Japanese food, presenting food and arranging it.
That's a very important point of Japanese food.
Yeah, indeed. We spoke a bit about one of those other sessions back there. So I don't know if anything is still available, but Culinary Historians of New York, you could look them up online, and if they are, I hope to see you tomorrow night.
Right. That's a beautiful space.
Yes, Globus, Globus Wash. It's really spectacular.
Right. Okay, so I'm sure you're going to have you here sometime soon. So
love to come back again.
Right,
thank you.
Please, so thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. My engineer today is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family and become a member. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.